Tonight is Monday, January 23rd. We're learning Parshat Shavuot of a class, of course. This week's Parsha is Parshat Bo. And here we have, in this Parsha, the third Parsha in the book of Exodus, the description of the last few plagues among the ten that were brought upon Paro and Egypt, and then the preparations and the commands for the exodus from Egypt, and the exodus itself, and the aftermath of the exodus. What we're going to talk about tonight, I've entitled The Multiple Meaning of Matzah, The Multiple Meaning of Matzah, and the sheets are in front of you. And I'd just like to give an introduction. I started working on this particular subject that we're going to talk about tonight, leading up to my engagement party when I got married, something about 30 years ago. So this was really one of the first Divrei Torah, one of the first Torah thoughts that I put together. And I still remember the reason I talked about it then is because my engagement party with my wife was over Pesach, over Passover. And this, of course, is related directly to Passover, to the holiday of the Exodus from Egypt. The party was going to be on a Motzei Shabbat on Saturday night, and I had prepared quite a bit before then, but I wasn't certain myself. I was a young man, not that familiar in the ways of Torah, and it was all going to be in Hebrew, and Hebrew was not my mother tongue, of course. So I remember that I literally spent a good deal of Shabbat afternoon, must have been 2, 3, or 4 hours, walking through the streets of Jerusalem and practicing what I was going to say. Thinking about it and practicing it. I went through all the different neighborhoods. And how it went Saturday night, I really don't remember. I assume that no one understood a word I said. So I hope you'll understand better. I hope it'll come out better tonight. So the place we're going to begin is by looking at a photocopy of two short passages in the Haggadah Pesach that I brought on the back of the first sheet and then on the next sheet. And this will serve as a short introduction to a study of some of the major themes in this week's Parsha, Parshat Bo. So here at the beginning of the Haggadah, this is from the Maxwell House Haggadah, but they're all the same, of course. The Hebrew is all the same in every Haggadah that you'll find around the world. If you look at the very, very bottom of the piece of paper, you'll see in very small print that this is from page 8 and page 9 of the Haggadah. So it means we're very near the beginning of the Haggadah. There's a lot of introductions in the earlier pages. Page 8 is right smack in the middle, I'm sorry, the beginning of the Haggadah. And it says, Ha lachma anya di halu av hatana ba'are de Mitzrayim. English translation, this is the bread of affliction which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. And many of us probably remember that we say this every year at the beginning of the Haggadah. In many families, we hold up the matzah and we say it. In our family, in our Seder, we actually have every person going around the room take the matzah, put it on his shoulder, and say this verse. And then the next person takes the matzah and says this verse. So what does the verse say? This is the bread of affliction which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. I want to point out two salient points in that statement. The second point is in the land of Egypt, in the Aramaic, Ba'ara de Mitzrayim. And the significance for our purposes is that it doesn't say that they ate this bread of affliction, this matzah. It doesn't say that they ate it when they fled out of Egypt, when they left Egypt. It doesn't say they ate it when they reached freedom. It says they ate it in the land of Egypt. In the land of Egypt. That's going to be extremely important as we go on. And the second salient point, in the order of the verses, the first point, is that we are calling the matzah lachma anya, the bread of affliction. We're not calling it the bread of freedom, not calling it the bread of liberation, rather the bread of affliction. And if I would translate affliction into a different, use a different English word, it would very well be slavery. This is the bread of slavery, of affliction, of pain, of suffering. So we're not saying that matzah is the bread of freedom that we ate when we left Egypt. We're saying it's the bread of slavery that we ate while we were in Egypt. And that, again, is going to be very, very significant. And before we go on, I want to point out that the word used here in the Aramaic for affliction, it's the third word in my bracket at the top, anya. Anya sounds just like, and it's the Aramaic equivalent of the Hebrew word oni, the same root. Oni in Hebrew, anya in Hebrew means affliction. And that word plays a central role in the Torah in the description of the bondage that our forefathers suffered in Egypt. And I will point that out by opening up the Tanakh and looking at the five or so verses that I put on the sheet. So first, if you look on the sheet on A1B1, at the top of the sheet, it says, look in Deuteronomy, right, Dvarim, chapter 16, verse 3. So if we do that, and we open up to Deuteronomy, chapter 16, verse 3, we don't even have to read the whole verse, but actually just a small part of it. And it says there, in the context of the discussion of the holiday of Passover, how that it celebrates our freedom from bondage in Egypt, it says, 16:3, you shall not eat anything leavened with it. It's talking about the Passover sacrifice. For 7 days thereafter you shall eat unleavened bread, bread of affliction. And the Hebrew is matzah, that's the bread of the unleavened bread, lechem oni, the bread of affliction, lechem oni. If you have the Hebrew, you can look, lechem oni. And again, lechem oni is written right in the Torah here as a synonym for matzah, for unleavened bread, and translated into Aramaic, it's lachma anya, what we have in our Haggadah. So it's just coming right from the Torah, and I said we'd show that that word, that phrase, lechem oni, bread of affliction, plays a central role in describing our bondage in Egypt. Well, that's the source I have in the sheet, in the bullet points. Let's just look at them one by one. The first is Bereishit, Genesis 15:13. So we go all the way back to Genesis 15:13. And the context here is the vision of God to Abraham, in which God tells Abraham the future, that your seed, your descendants, will be slaves in a foreign land. In Hebrew it's called Brit Bein Aptarim, the covenant between the parts, because in this vision, God makes a covenant with Abraham by having Abraham take animals and divide them into two pieces, and then the representation of God, the flame, comes down from heaven and goes between the pieces as an indication of a making of a blood covenant. But anyway, if we look there in 15:13, in this context, it says, God speaking, and he said to Avram, know well that your offspring shall be strangers in a land not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. And the word for oppressed is, can you read the Hebrew, Michael? I just don't have it in front of me. Ken. Again, v'inuotam, oppressed them, inuotam, it's the same word as oni, same word as anya. In other words, that root that's used for bread of affliction is the same root to describe our affliction in Egypt in these original verses that first set out that upcoming fate of the Israelites. And then throughout the story of our affliction, the word always used for the affliction is the same word. Let's just look at that. We're looking now in Shmot 1:11. That's Exodus chapter 1, verse 11. We'll find the same thing. And the verse says there, in chapter 1, verse 11, so they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built garrison cities for Paro. And when it says here in the English, oppress them, the Hebrew word is inu. The same Hebrew word, the same root, ayin, nun, hey, or ayin, nun, yud, or ayin, nun, vav. It's the same Hebrew root. And we'll see the same thing again in chapter 3, verse 7 of the book of Exodus. chapter 3, verse 7. And the Lord continued, I have marked well the plight of my people in Egypt and have heeded their outcry because of their taskmasters. Yes, I am mindful of their suffering. And the word for suffering in Hebrew, just let me make sure that I look in the Hebrew and got it right. So we're in 3:11, we said.
3:7.
3:7, thank you. 3:7. Yeah, so I almost got it wrong. The Hebrew says, "V'yomer Adonai ra'o ra'iti et oni ami Hashem Mitzrayim." God says, "I have certainly seen the plight of my people in Egypt." In my trend, the plight, and that word for plight is oni, the suffering. That same root, and we don't even have to look at the other sources. My point is that since the root, the Hebrew root used to describe the affliction and the bondage and the suffering and the pain of the Israelites in Egypt is ayin nun hey, therefore, when that same root appears in Deuteronomy and says, you should eat the bread of affliction, the same root, on this holiday, you know that it's called the bread of affliction, because somehow it comes to symbolize or commemorate the affliction that we suffered for all the years of our Egyptian slavery. And that's why I emphasized that the Haggadah doesn't say that we ate it in our flight to freedom after the slavery. It says we ate it ba'aret Mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt. It's trying to say this is the bread that we ate in Egypt, and it was part and parcel of, and it symbolized the oni, the suffering, the affliction of our forefathers in Egypt. We'll get later back to the deep significance of this. But for now, it's just collecting pieces of information. Okay, that's the first piece of information. And now, we flip through the Haggadah in a very, very fast Seder, and we go from page 8 to the next piece of paper, which you could see at the bottom, says 24. We went through about 18 pages of the Haggadah, and now we get to page 24 in the Maxwell House Haggadah, and it says that we show the matzah to the assembly. At this point, we pick up the matzah and show it to everyone, and it says, "Matzah zo sha'anu ochlim al shuma." This unleavened bread which we now eat, what does it mean? It is eaten because the dough of our ancestors had not time to become leavened before the Supreme King of Kings, the Most Holy, blessed be He, revealed Himself unto them and redeemed them. As it is said, they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they made any provision for themselves. Quoting verses from the Torah that we're going to see in another 15 minutes. Here, in this particular passage, from the same Haggadah we quoted from 5 minutes ago, here it says that the Israelites ate matzah, ate unleavened cakes, not in Egypt, but rather it says they ate it after they left Egypt, when they went forth out of Egypt. It says they went out quickly, didn't have time for the dough to rise, so they are forced to eat matzah. So see the contradiction here. The first part of the Haggadah that we saw calls matzah the bread of affliction and says we ate it in Egypt. Whereas this part of the Haggadah, much later in our Seder, says that we ate it when we had already left Egypt and we ate it in the fashion of unleavened bread because we didn't have time for our bread to leave, leaven, rise, as we were leaving. Which would mean that according to this passage I'm reading right now from the Haggadah, if I would try to ascertain from it what is the symbolism of matzah, I would say the symbolism is the symbolism of freedom or the symbolism of the flight to freedom. Because we ate it because we didn't have time to let the bread rise because we were so quickly moving from slavery to freedom. So the point I've been trying to make for the past few minutes is that the Haggadah Pesach, this text that we use every year for the Seder, has within it a clear internal contradiction. It says about the matzah, that same piece of cardboard bread, it says about it two conflicting things that are intention. First, it says that it's the bread of affliction that we ate in Egypt. And later it says it's the bread of slavery, of freedom, that we ate after leaving Egypt.
It's two meanings.
Two meanings, indeed. So, we have that? Anyone want a question or ask or point anything out? We're okay? We're good to go?
Good to go.
Okay. So that is all just background to now going through the Torah and trying to figure out the truth of this situation. So, we're putting the Haggadah aside. We can turn again to the front page that has the instructions for the sources we're going to see. And we're in B, and we have lots and lots of verses from this week's Torah portion to read through. We'll begin with chapter 11, verses 4 to 8. So we'll just go right there and begin reading. Chapter 11 of the books of Exodus is in this week's parsha, Parshat Bo. And here we go. 11, 4 to 8. Moshe said, "Thus says the Lord, towards midnight I will go forth among the Egyptians, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Paro who sits on his throne to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, and all the firstborn of the cattle." So first of all, even before we read on, we know that there were 10 plagues, and we know the last of the 10 was the plague of the firstborn. So putting ourselves now in the proper context, we realize that the verses we're now reading come after the 9 plagues. It's now the eve of the 10th plague, the plague of the firstborn. It might be the day before, it might be a week before, it might be a month before, but it's right before. Oh, thank you very much. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, but there was one right there on the windowsill.
But you...
But I didn't see it.
So we have a concept that's called schar psiot. You get reward for the steps you took. So you wanted to do the mitzvah in a more difficult fashion, so it'd be a greater mitzvah.
That's what you were thinking, wasn't it?
Say it again, please.
Where were we?
No, I'm just teasing.
Where were we? We're in chapter 11 of Exodus, verses 4 to 8. So these verses are being spoken by Moses to Paro in the name of God, which means that presumably God told him to say this. And Moses is warning Paro that very, very soon, at midnight, there's going to be a really terrible plague, more serious than all the 9 that came before it, and all the firstborn in Egypt will die. I'm going to read on in verse 6. "And there shall be a loud cry in all the land of Egypt, such as has never been or will ever be again. But not a dog shall snarl at any of the Israelites, a man or beast, in order that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Israel and Egypt." That's that same educational fact we talked about last week. "Then all these courtiers of yours shall come down to me," says Moses to Paro, "and bow low to me, saying, 'Depart, you and all the people who follow you.'" In other words, until now, Paro has refused to let the Israelites go. Moses says, "This plague will be so bad, you'll want us to go, you'll throw us out, you'll ask us to leave. After that I will depart. After that I and all my people leave Egypt." And he left Paro's presence in hot anger. So we read those verses just in order to set the context. So we know now the season, right? It's a day or a week or a month before they're going to leave. We know they left in the spring when we celebrate the holiday Passover. And then we read now the next chapter, chapter 12, verses 1 to 14. "The Lord said to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Egypt, 'This month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the months of the year for you.'" What that means is that God's saying, finally, you're about to leave Egypt for freedom, which means the Jewish people will now be born as an independent people. Until now, you were slaves, a ragtag bunch of slaves. You now become a people. And this month during which you're becoming a people, during which you're exiting the womb of Egypt, being born, as it were. This month will, from this point on, be the first month of the Jewish calendar, so that whenever you mark time, you'll be marking time in the framework of the birth of the Jewish people. You remember, the month that's the first month is the first month since redemption. The second month is the second month since redemption. Everything is based upon the reference point of redemption. And since it says this month shall be the beginning of months, it makes sense, although it's not necessary, but it makes sense that this was spoken the first day of the month. And that's what the tradition says. And of course, the month is what we today call Nisan. That's the month of the Jewish calendar during which the Israelites were born through exiting Egypt. Speak to the whole community of Israel. In other words, God says to Moses, what I'm about to say to you, you should say to the rest of the Jewish people. Speak to the whole community of Israel and say that on the 10th of this month, we can assume that's in another 9 days, if this is the first now, on the 10th of this month, the month of Nisan, that we call today Nisan, each of them shall take a lamb to a family, a lamb to a household. But if the household is too small for a lamb, let him share one with a neighbor who dwells nearby. In proportion to the number of persons, you shall contribute for the lamb according to what each household will eat. So there's more or less right amount of meat, so there won't be that much left over. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a yearly male. You shall take it from the sheep or from the goats. From this description, without blemish, a yearly male, we understand it's something like a sacrifice. A sacrifice.
Where would they get that?
That was what I was thinking.
Well, remember that they went down to Egypt hundreds of years earlier with lots and lots of flocks. And the original Pharaoh had said, you guys stay in Goshen and keep to your flocks. And if you have any really good shepherds, put them even over my flocks. And we assume that all these years that they were in slavery, they were still shepherds. The fact that they were slaves, let's not think of chattel slavery like in American plantation in the South. Think of people who lived in their families, probably still had their livelihood, but for a certain amount of days each month or hours each day or a certain amount of people in each household, they were forced into slavery to build the cities for Paro and to build the pyramids. But they maintained, apparently, their family structure and their households. You shall keep watch over it until the 14th day of this month. So again, this is being spoken the first of the month. On the 10th, you're supposed to select a lamb as this sacrifice. Keep it for 14 days. And then on the 14th day of this month, and all the assembled congregation of Israel shall slaughter it at twilight. What it means in twilight, it says Bein Ha'arbaim in Hebrew. It means in the late afternoon. So remember, the 14th of the month, the month we call Nisan, remember that Hebrew days go from evening to evening. So the 14th of the month is the very end of the 14th, before the sun goes down. You're supposed to slaughter this. They were told to slaughter this. And what to do with it? It says, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they are to eat it. They shall eat the flesh that night. That night means it's now going to be the 15th of the month after the sun goes down. They shall eat it roasted over the fire with unleavened bread. Ooh, that's what we're looking for. Unleavened bread, matzah. So there's a commandment here that's being given on the first day of the month of Nisan pertaining to the hours after the end of the 14th of Nisan, in other words, the 15th of Nisan, to have a meal at that time with a goat or sheep that's been slaughtered, to eat it with two other components. After roasting over fire, to eat it with matzah and bitter herbs, marorim. Maror, what we call today maror. You're supposed to eat Pesach, that's the name of the goat, right? The Pesach sacrifice. Pesach, matzah, and maror. And just note one amazing fact that we won't talk about right now, but it's very important. We'll get to another few minutes. This commandment, to eat the matzah, is being given before, long before they left Egypt. Long before they didn't have time for their dough to rise. This is before that happened. They're still in Egypt. They're still slaves. And the commandment's being given 14 days earlier. The historical events of having dough that didn't have time to rise, having to bake it as matzah, those events did not happen yet, and they won't happen for another 14 days. And obviously we'll have to ask ourselves, as we will later, why, oh why, is there a commandment to eat matzah at this stage, while they're still in Egypt, while they're still slaves? Okay?
Because if they have all that warning, they could have made bread that rose.
Of course they could have. Of course they could have. Right? Good point. They had 14 days. But the commandment is specifically to eat unleavened bread, specifically to eat matzah. Verse 9, do not eat any of it raw or cooked in any way with water, but roasted head, legs, and entrails over the fire. You shall not leave any of it over until morning. If any of it is left until morning, you shall burn it. Let me just stop for a minute and tell you shortly what we talked about last time. I mean, last year, about this time of year. Was it in this room? In this room, yeah. I looked at my notes. I wouldn't have remembered this. Last year, when we studied this parsha, Parshat Bo, we talked about the significance, the symbolism of the Paschal lamb, the goat or the sheep. Okay. Does anyone remember what we said?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that it was really a really act of faith for them to put this lamb out in their front yard and roast it on a spit. Because the lamb was sacred to the Egyptians, and that was sort of like they were denying the sacredness of this of their idol.
Absolutely, that's a gold star. That's 3 points. That's what we talked about. That the lamb and the goat seems to have been, according to other verses, both at the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus, among the symbols that were worshipped as God figures in Egypt. And by commanding us to slaughter it, we're being commanded to slaughter the gods of Egypt, which is an act of extricating yourself from the culture of the land, from the religion of the land. And Carolyn's an act of faith, exactly that. In other words, it would be extremely difficult to slaughter that lamb, because that says, I'm not part of the Egyptian culture, I'm repudiating it, I'm doing an act of civil disobedience. It would be similar to burning an American flag on your front lawn. That's why it says to hold the lamb in waiting for 4 days so everyone can see what you're about to do, and roast it over an open fire so it makes a lot of smoke. You can't hide it in the oven. Right? And put the blood on your doorpost. That's like smearing the ashes of the American flag on your front door and flaunting it. And this is an act in which the Israelites are asked to decide who they are. Are you part of the Egyptian culture that you've been part of for at least 210 years? Do you want to continue in the idolatrous ways of Mitzrayim? And according to the Midrashim and verses, most of the Israelites were idolaters. Or are you willing to follow Moses in the way of God toward the Promised Land, which means when repudiating the culture that you're part of? That was an extremely difficult act. And that's the way the Jewish people are taking that step to merit being redeemed. The Midrash says that 4/5 of them didn't do it and stayed in Egypt. Even if we don't take that Midrash literally, when the Senate's trying to point out to us the conflict, the inner conflict, the difficulty of doing this sacrifice. And for some reason, we'll talk about another few minutes, the sacrificial lamb was to be eaten with unleavened bread. Now, eaten with bitter herbs, that's clear. The bitter herbs symbolize the 210 years of slavery. The lamb symbolizes their efforts to extricate themselves, the willingness to follow God and repudiate Egyptian culture. What does the unleavened bread symbolize? We'll get to that later. Verse 11. This is how you shall eat it, your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it hurriedly. It is a Passover offering to the Lord. So apparently they're supposed to be feeling that at any minute during this meal, they're going to leave Egypt. They have to be ready. And indeed we've learned in the verses we saw earlier that it'll be at midnight that the plague of the firstborn will occur and Paro will throw the Israelites out of his land. For that night I will go through the land of Egypt and strike down every firstborn in the land, both man and beast. I will mete out punishments to all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. And the blood on the houses where you're staying shall be a sign for you. It will be a sign showing that you took the effort to separate yourself, distance yourself from Egyptian culture. When I see the blood, I'll pass over you, so that no plague will destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day shall be to you one of remembrance. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord throughout the ages. You'll celebrate it as an institution for all time. I'm going to stop there. So let's just summarize and point out a few things. The verses we read were God speaking to Moses to tell the Israelites, but we haven't yet read that Moses told the Israelites. That we haven't seen yet. And we also realize that this is a commandment to be fulfilled then and there on the 14th day of the month, the 10th of the month to take the lamb, the 14th day of the month at the end of the day in the afternoon to sacrifice it, kill it, slaughter it, and then that night, the beginning of the 15th of the month, to eat it in this special meal, and then they're going to be taken out of Egypt at the end of that meal. And further, we're told in verse 14 that this day shall be celebrated as a festival every single year from that point on. So there should be a festal meal, which we call a Seder, not just that year, but every single year until the end of time, as we do today. And we call it the Seder with the same three symbols, Pesach, Maror, Maror, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, the Paschal lamb, and the Matzah, and the bitter herbs. Ready to go on? Okay.
Can I just ask, were the Israelites in a camp? How did we know who the Israelites were?
So we have two pieces of information that we could bring into it. One is that at the beginning of the exile, back at the end of Genesis, it says that all of the Israelites, then there was only 70, encamped in Goshen, in one particular area. On the other hand, at least some commentators say that the fact that blood is necessary to be put on the doorpost to distinguish between Israelite and Egyptian would seem to indicate that they live among the Egyptians in mixed neighborhoods, not in a ghetto. And indeed, there's many midrashim that point out, again, this is Midrash, it's not in the text of the Torah, but the Midrashim point out that although they began living in ghettos, over the course of all these years, they assimilated into Egyptian society, buying houses in Egyptian neighborhoods, and wearing Egyptian clothes, going to Egyptian schools, Egyptian discotheques, Egyptian music, and also Egyptian religion.
So there was intermarriage.
I don't know if there's intermarriage.
I would imagine.
Let me think if we have any evidence. Yes. Yes, right. There is a verse in the book of Numbers that talks about the guy who went out and started cursing in the camp, and it says he was the son of an intermarriage, that either his father or his mother, don't remember, was Egyptian. Yeah, so we have one case like that.
Wasn't Joseph's wife Egyptian? Also?
Good example, right? That's a good example. If Joseph, the leader of the Israelites, did it, then perhaps others followed in his footsteps.
But that's an interesting.
That's 2 points.
Oh, interesting you. Point. Also, I never thought about it. But how does Moses even address the Jew or the Israelites? I mean, if they're scattered all about, it's not like he could just walk into an area and start talking about his God and what's going to happen. Wonder how he was able to.
I guess he wrote newspaper articles.
He had a blog.
Right, he had a blog. But it does say that he gathered the elders, right? And the elders that went to their groups, their tribes.
Okay.
Yeah. Did I miss something funny?
In my mind, I'm not sure if you ever saw the Ten Commandments, but I see all the Jews in the quarries cutting up stones.
Right.
This isn't how it was. They were slaves part-time and integrated members of the society the other time?
I don't know exactly. On the one hand, we can divide between different historical periods. That when they first went down to Egypt, they were citizens and they were integrated and they had their professions, etc., and started to assimilate. At a certain point, the slavery began.
Sort of a gradual thing.
They gradual process,
more and more
right?
Restrictions
right.
on them.
More and more restrictions. My teacher, Nahama Leibowitz, always compared it to Hitler with the Nuremberg laws, and then more and more greater restrictions and discrimination. until you get to throwing the children into the sea. But even at the very end, it looks like it wasn't slavery of the type in the movie, because they did have their households, and they did have their families, they did have their goats and their kids.
And they were obviously integrated into community because they had to mark their doors.
Right, that's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. So you have to revise the film.
Right. My whole way of thinking.
I'm lucky I didn't see it, so I'm not influenced. Okay.
I thought every Jew is in.
Yeah.
No, let's put her on the roof.
Fiddler on the roof. I saw her alive, but I didn't see the movie. Okay, so now we're going to go on to another set of verses. In my sheet, we're now looking at B3, which has us looking at verse 15. And it's important that I'm separating verse 14 from 15. Right? 14 we read already as part of the first 14 verses of this chapter 12, whereas verse 15, even though the JPS doesn't agree with me, because they put it as part of the same paragraph, I am supposing, I'm claiming, that verse 15 is really a new paragraph, a new idea.
So we're still chapter 12?
Still chapter 12. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Now the reason I say that's a new paragraph is because verses 1 to 14 talked about the meal on the end of the 14th of the month and the beginning of the 15th, but it didn't talk about a 7-day holiday and gave us no basis for a 7-day holiday. The idea of a 7-day holiday in verse 15 is new, completely new. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the very first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats unleavened bread from the first day to the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And notice, in the first 14 verses, not only was there no mention of a 7-day holiday, there was no mention of any prohibition against leaven. It just said, eat matzah, eat unleavened bread. It didn't say, don't eat leavened bread. It didn't say that. That prohibition is new in verse 15. So verse 15 brings two new things, a 7-day holiday as opposed to just a meal, and this prohibition against having leaven in your houses. And then verse 16, you shall celebrate a sacred occasion on the first day and a sacred occasion on the seventh day. We're still talking the 7-day holiday. No work at all shall be done on them. Only whatever person is to eat, that alone shall be prepared for you. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For on this very day I brought your ranks out of the land of Egypt. You shall observe this day throughout the ages and institute for all time. Now notice, the meal we read about earlier was not a meal about leaving Egypt, because that meal was to be eaten when they were still slaves in Egypt. But now this 7-day holiday is something else. It has the same matzah as its centerpiece, but it's not the same thing. That was 1 day, this is 7 days. That had no prohibition against unleavened bread, this is a prohibition. That, whatever it was about, that meal, it wasn't about freedom, because freedom hadn't happened yet. But this meal, I'm sorry, this 7-day holiday is about bringing your ranks out of the land of Egypt. It's about freedom. You shall observe this day throughout the ages and institute for all time. I assume the day here means this 7-day holiday.
But wasn't there a reference to the 1-day holiday that they were girded, like ready to go?
Ready to go, but haven't gone yet. Haven't gone yet.
But couldn't it be interpreted as a holiday?
You know what? Actually, it could be. I was pushing my luck there, and you called my bluff. You're right. That's 2 points also.
She got three.
But you only got
that we're counting.
You know what? I could have said the opposite. All Carol Ann did is remember what we said last year. You actually did better, because you proved that something I said was not totally correct.
Take it away.
But I guess...
Maybe we'll divide this side of the room and that side of the room, and the male will just sit here and be quiet.
Verse 18. In the first month, right? That's, we already said this will be the first month of the year. From the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. Here I'm going to confuse you a little bit. It looks like when the Torah says the 14th day of the month at evening, that's really what we would call the 15th of the month. It's when the 14th ends at evening and becomes night, then it's the 15th of the month. So, sorry about that confusion. Now, notice that this seven-day holiday overlaps with that meal discussed earlier. That meal was to be had at the end of the 14th, the beginning of the 15th of the month, at nighttime, and then the seven-day holiday begins at the same time that that meal is being eaten, but it goes on for seven full days. Is that clear? Should I say it again? Verse 19, no leaven shall be found in your houses for 7 days, for whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the community of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a citizen of the country. You shall eat nothing leavened in all your settlements. You shall eat unleavened bread. Great. Remember that all that we just read was God speaking to Moshe and telling him to say this to the Jewish people. But we didn't read yet that Moses said it to the Jewish people. Now, the next verse, new beginning, verse 21, is Moses, after hearing all this, going to the Israelites, to the Jewish people, and telling them what he heard from God. And look how he summarizes what he heard from God. Moses, in verse 21, then summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go, pick out lambs for your families and slaughter the Passover offering. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and to the two doorposts. None of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning, for when the Lord goes through to smite the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts, and the Lord will pass over the door and not let the destroyer enter and smite your home. You shall observe this as an institution for all time, for you and for your descendants. When you enter the land the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite. And when your children ask you, what do you mean by this rite? You shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved our houses. The people then bowed low in homage, and the Israelites went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. Now this is confusing. We read all the things that God said to Moses to tell the Israelites. And now we read what Moses said to the Israelites, and there's a discrepancy. There's more than one discrepancy.
Left out the seven-day holiday.
Right. He left out completely the seven-day holiday. No remnant of it. He just talks about the meal, the one-time meal for that one night to be celebrated as a rite every single year. But he just talks about that one meal, not 7 days. What else is missing? A lot of things are missing.
Well, he doesn't tell him to go. The time frame is different. He doesn't tell him about getting it and then keeping it for 4 days. And
yeah, that's all missing, right? Take it on the 10th day, keep it to the 14th day. That's missing.
And what kind of thing to get?
Right, doesn't say. Is it a...
Or how to prepare it.
How to prepare it?
Mm-hmm.
A lot is missing. What else is missing?
Your matzah.
Say it again. The matzah is missing, right? One of the most important things, the matzah and the bitter herbs are missing. It just mentions the lamb itself. So we have now a dilemma. We see that much is missing from what's recorded that Moses said to the people. And the question is, either he said everything he was supposed to say, and it's just not recorded, or he didn't say everything he was supposed to say, and then we have to ask, well, why didn't he say what he was supposed to say? So I'm going to just talk about those two possibilities for a moment. They're both possible. It could be that he didn't say everything he was supposed to say for a reason. And we'll see, as we read the verses later, it really is the case that he didn't say everything because he said it later. We'll read later that he waited to say certain things. But on the other hand, there are other things that perhaps he did say and they're not recorded here. And it could be that the Torah doesn't want to say that God said to Moses, tell the people X, Y, and Z, and go on for 20 verses, and then, right, and Moses said to the people X, Y, and Z, and repeat the same 20 verses. It's a waste of ink. It's a waste of space. And many times the Torah tells us that God said to Moses, tell the people X, And then when Moses tells the people, there are different details written. You just have to assume that all the details were said by Moses, by God to Moses, and they were all said by Moses to the people. But in the first case, it gives us some of the details. Second case gives us some others. But we know they're all part of the same package. Just to say it clear again, God said to Moses, say the whole thing, and Moses said the whole thing, but it's just written a little bit here, a little bit there. That's certainly possible. So I'm going to make a claim here. I'm going to make a hypothesis, and then I'll try and back it up as we read further. I'm going to claim the following. As far as the meal, Moses said everything he was supposed to say to the people right now. As far as the seven-day holiday, Moses said nothing, but he saves it all for later. Now, on what basis do I make that claim? The following basis. Since the people now have to go and have that meal, it's right now, before the plague of the firstborn, they have to take the lamb, they have to hold it for 4 days, they have to sacrifice, they have to eat it with the matzah and the bitter herbs, they have to put the blood on the doorpost. I would like to assume Moses said all that, because the people have to do it. And indeed, it does say in verse 28 that we just read, and the Israelites went and did so just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. Everything that the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, even though it doesn't say that they said everything, but the people did it, assumes that Moses did tell them to do it. So for that meal, everything that they had to do, they were told and that they did. But for the seven-day holiday, my hypothesis is Moses didn't even mention it. And we'll prove that by reading later that he mentioned it all later, the seven-day holiday. You're wondering, so why is this important? It's very important, as we're about to see. Okay, let's now read on. And we're in verse 28, 29, until 34. On my sheet, this is B5. We read 28 already. We'll read it again and go on. And the Israelites went and did so just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. In the middle of the night, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of the Paro who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Paro arose in the night with all his courtiers and all the Egyptians, because there was a loud cry in Egypt, for there was no house where there was not someone dead. Just as God had promised, that's what happened. He summoned Moses and Aaron in the night, that's Paro, and what did he say? He said, "Up, depart from among my people, you and the Israelites with you, go worship the Lord as you said, take also your flocks and your herds as you said, and be gone. And may you bring a blessing upon me also." The Egyptians urged the people on, impatient to have them leave the country, for they said, "We're all dead. God's going to kill us all if we don't get rid of these Israelites quickly." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their netting bowls wrapped in their cloaks upon their shoulders. Read on to verse 37. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. Moreover, a mixed multitude went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds, and they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had taken out of Egypt, who was not leavened, since they had been driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. So what do we have now? We have the following picture. They had sat down on that night to a meal with the lamb, the blood on the doorpost, the bitter herbs, and the unleavened bread, the matzah. And they ate it. And then they apparently knew they're going to be going out of Egypt, Moses told them. So they prepare all this dough and set it out in the netting troughs to rise, expecting, apparently, to be told that they'll wake up in the morning and have to leave Egypt, and then the dough will have risen, they'll be able to bake it and leave. But no, what happened is that Paro immediately threw them out, middle of the night. They weren't ready for it, didn't make their provisions yet, they thought they'd do it in the morning. And they end up having all this dough that they have to take out with them before it's leavened. And they end up eating it on the way, as unleavened bread. what seems to be is that they expected this dough to rise, but didn't have time. Now, why did they expect the dough to rise? Because they never heard any commandment against eating leavened bread. That whole 7-day holiday, don't have unleavened bread, they weren't told that by Moses. He waited to tell them, as we're about to see, he says it later. All they heard was a commandment to eat the Paschal lamb and the bitter herbs and the matzah, that one meal, and they thought after that meal they'd be having bread the next morning. But they couldn't have bread because they were forced to flee, and they ended up eating the next morning the same cardboard bread that they ate the night before. The night before it was a commandment. But in the morning it wasn't a commandment, it was a fact. How do you say in English?
Substantiated?
I don't know the word, sorry. It was a force of circumstance. It wasn't a commandment that they ate matzah again in the morning. Still with me? Okay. Okay, so now we have a little bit more to read before we can put these things together. We're now on my sheet in the last set of verses. It's B6, Shmot chapter 13, verses 1 to 12. Exodus 13, 1 to 12. So we read already that they left Egypt. They went from Ramses to Sukkot. They're out of there. They're in the desert. They're on the way. They're going towards the Reed Sea. And then it says in chapter 13, the Lord spoke further to Moses, saying, consecrate to me every firstborn, man and beast, the first issue of every womb among the Israelites is mine. Now, we can understand this mitzvah completely, because since in Egypt, the firstborn of everything Egyptian was killed, so now every firstborn Jew feels, wow, I'm happy that I didn't get it, right? I owe my life to God. So every firstborn at this point is consecrated to God, in that sense. So the Lord's, I'm reading verse 1 again, Lord spoke for to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn man and beast, the first issue of every womb among the Israelites is mine. And Moses said to the people, now what do you expect Moses to say? You expect him to talk about this firstborn thing, right? But he doesn't. Look what he says. And Moses said to the people, remember this day on which you went free from Egypt, the house of bondage, how the Lord freed you from it with a mighty hand. No leavened bread shall be eaten. You shall go free in this day in the month of Aviv, that's the month of Nisan. So when the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Yebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you land for milk and honey, you shall observe in this month the following practice. 7 days! You shall eat unleavened bread. And on the 7th day, there shall be a festival of the Lord throughout the 7 days. Unleavened bread shall be eaten, no leavened bread shall be found with you, no leaven shall be found in all your territory. We recognize this. This is what God said to Moses in chapter 12 to tell the Israelites, but Moses waited until now to tell them. They didn't know about the 7-day holiday when they first left. That's why they were hoping to eat, think to eat bread. They didn't know there was a prohibition. Apparently there was no prohibition. Moses tells them about the 7-day holiday only after they leave, which means the 7-day holiday is not for that year. It's for the next year and for the future. They had the meal that first year, of course, with the matzah and the bitter herbs and the Pesach sacrifice, but there was no prohibition against eating leaven the next morning. They expected to eat it. They had matzah because they didn't have time for the bread to rise, but I guess, I'm sure, after that first matzah of the morning, they eventually had some bread. There was no 7-day holiday. Then Moses later told them of 7-day holiday. That's for the future. 7-day holiday of no leaven. Then it goes on to talk about the 7-day holiday, and then Moses goes on to tell them the commandment of the consecration of the firstborn. Fine.
How do you figure it was a year later?
No, I'm not saying that Moses said it a year later. He said it a few days later.
But he told them somehow that it's not for now, it's for later.
Apparently it's not for now, because he said a 7-day holiday beginning on the day you left Egypt, but they already left Egypt. Mm-hmm. Right. He's telling them too late to keep the holiday from the beginning. And that leads us to believe that it's not for this year at all. And now I'm finally going to explain why. We're going to put things together. So it looks like we have the following. We really have here two different holidays and two different celebrations and two different matzahs. Let me explain what I mean. One holiday is a holiday that's centered around one meal. It's a holiday of a few hours. It begins in the afternoon of the 14th of the month when they slaughter the lamb, put the blood on the doorpost. It goes on as they roast it. It goes on as they eat it that night with their loins girded. They eat it with matzah and maror. And that's that. That's one holiday. The Torah later calls this holiday, in other books of the Torah, calls it the holiday of Passover, Chag HaPesach. And it's just a 12-hour holiday. According to the Halakha, it's a 12-hour holiday from noon to midnight. That's all. It doesn't say noon to midnight in these verses. It says from the afternoon to midnight. And the center of that holiday is eating the Passover sacrifice, the bitter herbs and the matzah, and there's no prohibition against leaven. There isn't. We didn't read about one. There shouldn't be. And what's the symbolism of this holiday? Well, the centerpiece of it is the Paschal Lamb, which we said is a symbol, and it's also a vehicle of the repudiation of Egyptian culture. It's the leap of faith. It's the act that gives the Israelites the merit to become Jews, the repudiation of idolatry. And they eat that Passover with two symbols. The bitter herbs and the matzah. The bitter herbs, we clearly know what they symbolize. They symbolize bitter herbs, the bitterness of slavery. In this last meal, they're remembering the slavery that they're eating, that they're leaving, excuse me. Now, what about the matzah? This is the matzah that they ate in Egypt. In Egypt, they ate it, right? What did the Haggadah tell us about the matzah they ate in Egypt? That it's called Lachma Anya, the bread of affliction. From the verse in Deuteronomy that says, there's matzah, bread of affliction. This matzah of this meal, of this 12-day holiday, this matzah and only this matzah is the bread of affliction. What do I mean? Here we have to assume something that's not written anywhere, but it makes a lot of sense. If in this last meal, as slaves, before going to freedom, they're being asked to eat a meal with bitter herbs and the bread of affliction, it must be that that matzah symbolizes affliction, symbolizes slavery. That's why it's called the bread of affliction. How could this cardboard bread symbolize affliction? Well, just think how tasteless it is from personal experience. Think of how hard it is to digest. It has no flavor, no spice. It really could and should symbolize slavery, affliction, right? It's really unpleasant to eat. We can go one step further and assume, although you don't have to assume this, but it makes sense, that perhaps for the years of slavery, perhaps the Jews, I should call them the Israelites, ate matzah. Why would they eat matzah? Why would they eat it? Well, if we assume that the Egyptians gave the slaves food, then the best thing to give them is matzah, because it's cheap. Don't invest too much in your slaves, and also last a long time in their stomachs. They don't have to eat more than once a day. If we assume, which I would tend to assume, that it's really that the Israelites made their own food, and they weren't given food, then if your time is not your own, you're always being driven from task to task, you never have time actually to make and eat a leisurely meal, then you don't have time to make bread. You can't buy it in Tom Thumb at Walmart. Bread takes a long time to rise. If your time is not your own, then you'll eat matzah. Just throw the ingredients together, stick it in the oven, and eat it. So we could assume, and again, this is not in the realm of pshat, but it fits into things we're saying, that for many of the years of slavery, they ate matzah, either because it's tasteless and lasts a long time, and the Egyptians therefore gave it to them, or because it's the bread that someone whose time is not in his own hands would make for himself. And then we'd say that in their last meal as slaves, when they're having the sacrificial lamb that symbolizes their extrication from this slavery of Egypt, they're eating together with the matzah that symbolizes that slavery and the bitter herbs that symbolize their slavery. A last meal of slaves, with a hint of freedom, the extrication from the idolatry of Egypt in the lamb, the symbol of the lamb. And if all this is true, or make some sense, then what would you be thinking about and what you would be dreaming about in a culinary sense when you know tomorrow we're going to be free men and women? Dreaming about eating bread. Because bread has some taste to it. Bread is fluffy. Bread doesn't get... What type of bread you're talking about? McDonald's. No. And also, not only is it tasty and so much better than that matzah we've been eating for so many years, but the matzah is symbolic, we would say, of freedom. Because it takes a long time to rise. And it shows that your time is in your own hands. You're a master of your own fate. You can do whatever you want. You can sit around and wait for it to rise. Not like slaves who have to eat matzah because the time is not their own. And then just imagine that. You have all these Israelites eating this last meal as slaves with the matzah, the bitter herbs, and the sacrificial lamb, hoping and dreaming and thinking about being free men and women the next day when we'll finally eat bread. And what happens? Against their will, they're thrown out so quickly that the next morning they have to eat again matzah. The same bread they ate as slaves, they have to eat again the next morning because they don't have time for their bread to rise. They're thrown out so quickly. But when they eat it the next morning, they're already free. Not only are they already free the next morning, but the matzah now turns, it undergoes a metamorphosis from being a symbol of slavery, the bread of affliction, now becomes the bread of freedom. Because they're eating it now, because they were thrown out to freedom so quickly, it's enough time for the bread to rise. So the symbol of slavery becomes the symbol of freedom. And my next claim, the next stage in this thought process, is that the matzah that's part of the meal, that one night holiday, that matzah, like we said, is the bread of slavery, lechem only, the bread of affliction. But the matzah eaten the next morning, we said, is the bread of freedom. And that seven-day holiday that they'll only begin celebrating next year, that seven-day holiday is the holiday of freedom. They didn't celebrate it the first year because they weren't yet free. But when that first year they became free in a process of having to quickly flee the country so that the bread didn't rise, in the course of that flight to freedom, matzah became a symbol of freedom. So the next year, when they have the seven-day holiday, the matzah is a symbol of freedom. So in the context of the 12-hour holiday, the meal that's called Passover, matzah there is a symbol of slavery. But in the context of the seven-day holiday that they begin celebrating next year, there, the holiday is not called, by the way, Passover. It's called the holiday of Matzah. That's what the verses say. Today we call the seven-day holiday Pesach, Passover. That's incorrect according to the Bible. According to the Bible, the meal on the nighttime is called the meal of Pesach. But the seven-day holiday is called the holiday of Matzah. In the framework of the holiday of Passover, Pesach, the matzah is the bread of affliction. In the framework of the seven-day holiday, it's the holiday of matzah, the matzah of freedom, because their dough didn't have time to rise. The same symbol has a new meaning. One more point. It's too late, unfortunately, but for everything I wanted to do. But one more point is that although the first year, when they left, there was only one holiday. Pesach. Bread of affliction. Then they left quickly, it became the bread of freedom. Next year they have the seven-day holiday. But notice that these two holidays overlap. The holiday of Pesach, of the sacrificial lamb with the matzah and the bitter herbs, is on the end of the 14th, the afternoon when the sun's going down, until midnight when they're eating the meal. The holiday of unleavened bread, the seven-day holiday, begins when the sun goes down on the 14th and goes for 7 days. So that in all future years, when we're having that meal on the 14th, we're celebrating two holidays at once. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. This is so important for understanding, by the way, not just these verses, but all of our celebration in the spring that we call Passover. When we sit down to what we call the Seder meal, we're celebrating two holidays at once. We're celebrating Hag HaPesach, the holiday of Pesach, in which the matzah is the symbol of slavery. But we're also beginning the holiday of freedom, the holiday of matzah, which the matzah is the bread of freedom. And now we go back to the Haggadah. That's why in the Haggadah there were two conflicting statements of what the matzah symbolizes. Because we're celebrating two separate holidays with two separate matzot, if you will, and each of them has a different meaning. So if we go and open the Haggadah now, we'll read again on page 1, which was page 8. This is the bread of affliction, which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. What holiday is that? That's the holiday of Passover. And it really is the bread of affliction. That symbolizes the slavery of 210 years, which they were afflicted, and symbolized by this afflicting bread that you can hardly digest and has no taste. And the halakha says, we won't have time to read this, but it's on the sheet I brought, the halakha says the matzah has to taste crummy. No sweetening. No oil, no chocolate, no raisins. It has to be bland and hard and cardboard, because it's the bread of affliction. And furthermore, it has to be made very quickly. Not merely so that it won't become leaven, but rather because the very symbolism of it is that it reminds us that our time was not our own. We didn't have time, as slaves, to make our own bread. That's the bread of affliction. But the say that goes on, and then we get to the other page, page 24, which we suddenly read a conflicting statement of the symbolism of matzah. This unleavened bread, which we now eat, what does it mean? Could have answered, it means bread of affliction. It doesn't say that. It is eaten because the dough of our ancestors had not time to become leavened. Before the Supreme King of Kings, the Most Holy, Blessed be He, revealed Himself unto them and redeemed them, as it is said, they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought forth out of Egypt was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they made any provisions for themselves. This is a different explanation of the matzah. It's the matzah that symbolizes the flight to freedom. It symbolizes freedom. And it's the matzah, not of the holiday of the meal. It's not the matzah of Pesach, of Passover. It's the matzah of the seven-day holiday, which we celebrate to remember the flight to freedom. But these two holidays have an overlap. The night when we're eating, the Seder, is the overlap between the two holidays, so we, in a certain sense, have two different matzot. One symbolizes slavery, and the other symbolizes freedom. That's the first third of our class tonight. But since time is very, very short, we have to summarize the rest of it. What we just learned is the exegetical part of it. It's the verses, it's the words in the Haggadah, it's the text. And to me, it's just exciting to understand the text, to sort things out, and understand really what's happening step after step, and that's great and that's important. But it's also as important to understand the theological significance of what we're talking about. Because we come up against a question that has to be asked, which is, why is it that one foodstuff symbolizes two different ideas, two opposing ideas? Right, the Torah, God, could have made it different. It could have been that waffles symbolize slavery and bicycles symbolize freedom. It could have been arranged anyway. We could have left each of us on bicycles. Every year we'd ride bicycles to remember our freedom. But why did God arrange it that the same symbol that represents so vividly slavery became the symbol of freedom? That, to me, is an important question. So to make a long story short, it looks like there's only one thing you can say here. If you want to say anything, of course you can say nothing and say there's no meaning to it, I'm not searching for meaning, I'll just accept exegesis and go home and eat my matzah. But if you want to look for some type of deeper significance, to to me, it looks clear that there's a statement here that there's a greater similarity between slavery and freedom than that which we would have thought. If it would be two different symbols, I'd say slavery is black and freedom is white, or this is pink and this is gray. Two different things. But if it's the same symbol, then I would say it's a message that there's an affinity between slavery and freedom. And to say what that affinity might be, we have to simply look at so many verses in the Torah that say that the Jewish people are meant to be servants of God. And when it says that we're meant to be servants of God, on the sheet I brought one verse, but there's lots of verses. I'm looking at E1. The same word used to describe slavery to Paro is the same word you describe servitude to God, to be an Eved, servant, slave. It could have been that bread would be the symbol of freedom. It could have been arranged historically. And then I'd say, okay, slavery is when your time is not your own. Slavery is when you're forced about by a taskmaster from X to Y to Z. Slavery is when your bread is like cardboard and there's no taste and there's no sweetness. Whereas freedom is raisin bread and it's fluffy and there's time for it to rise. It symbolizes that your time is your own. You can do whatever you want. That it's tasty and there's autonomy and there's different tastes and sweetness. That could have been. But when the same symbol that's a symbol of slavery becomes a symbol of freedom, the message just might be that there's an element of servitude in freedom. That true freedom in some sense, which we'll have to explain, true freedom in some sense has to do with serving a higher cause. And without the higher cause, without the idea of mission, without the idea of being dedicated to ideas that somehow bind you, without that, what you would call freedom is not freedom at all. Just to summarize that, I brought here, let's say, from the words of Martin Buber, a famous Jewish philosopher in the middle of the 20th century. He writes, I'm in E4, freedom is not a matter that can be actualized according to any whim, arbitrarily. Rather, the central meaning of freedom and its very purpose is the fulfillment of an ideal. To me, that's just so clear. To put it in more religious language, in E3, one of the most famous poets and philosophers of the Middle Ages, Jewish philosophers and poets, writes, temporal slaves are indeed the slaves of slaves, while only the slave of God is truly free. Therefore, as every human being searches for his portion, my soul says, God is my portion. Now, I would say that if we'd leave everything at this point and go home, we've said almost nothing meaningful. Because it's like a game. Playing with words. What we basically just said is that slavery to God is freedom. Okay, but then why is it called freedom and not called slavery to God? I mean, or let's put it differently. Okay, you claim, me, Hanan Schlesinger, that slavery to God is freedom. And that's what the symbolism of matzah teaches us. Okay, but why is it freedom? What right does the Torah have to call slavery freedom, and to call freedom slavery? That's just playing with words, and that's it's pulling the wool over your eyes. I can certainly say, no, what are you talking about? Freedom is freedom. Freedom is when I can do my own thing, and slavery is when someone else tells me what to do. Whether it's God telling me what to do, or someone else telling me what to do, that's slavery. Freedom is when no one tells me what to do, not God and not someone else. That's simple. What's this mixing up of concepts and saying that real freedom is when you're a slave to God? How could that be? That's, to me, the important question. It's true that the Torah claims that servitude to God is true freedom. The Torah claims it in many places, and we've seen it in the story of matzah. That, to me, that's clear. But what does it really mean? What do you mean? In what sense is it that slavery to God is freedom? So, although we only have 6 minutes, 7 minutes, and this is really an important philosophical question, I'll try. and perhaps only give one approach. There's two approaches to this question. Let me speak from my own experience. I often find, and I found this for 40 years, that I get the most accomplished of what I want to accomplish when I have a deadline. When I have, if you will, a taskmaster. When I have things I have to get done at a certain time. And I get the least accomplished when I'm on vacation. When there's no framework, there's no obligations, I can have all the good intentions of reading that pile of books, but it doesn't get done. Why doesn't it get done? Because I have good intentions, there are things I want to do, but I also have within me another voice, another part of me, that says you can do it tomorrow, you can do something else now, you'll get it done another time. In other words, I experience, and many people experience, inner tension, conflicts. Anyone who's on a diet, and everyone's been on a diet at one point or another, knows that you want to go on a diet, you want to go on a diet, but there's another part of you that wants to have the cookies. And there's an inner conflict. And the question is, who is the real you? I know who the real you is. The real you is the one that just wants to go on a diet. So then who's the other you? There's another force in there. There's a material force. There's one that's not looking out for your best interest in the overall, it's looking out for your short-term interest. So, getting back to the matter, I want to be me. I want to do what I want to do. But I'm so often unable to do what I want to do because there's a second I in there that's not really me, that's pushing me in different directions. I want to go on a diet. But a different I, and perhaps I shouldn't even call it I, but it's an imposter there, is telling me to have another cookie. It doesn't matter. You're hungry. You deserve it. Or if on vacation, the I in me wants to read 5 books, but another I there says, it's too hard, and you'd really rather go to sleep, and you have other things to do. I want to follow the real I, and I don't want to get sidetracked by that other force. But I, sometimes, often don't have the inner willpower to be who I really am. I need a deadline. I need an external force to force me to be what I really want to be. I need Weight Watchers to tell me to eat what I really want to eat and not what that other force inside me wants to eat. So claims Rav Avram Yitzhak HaKohen Kuk that that's what we mean when we say that service to God is true freedom. Rav Kuk understands that the true Torah, properly understood, is a framework to teach you, help you, force you, command you to do what you really want to do, what that true I has for you. And it is therefore an aid to help you overcome that lazy, material, corporally driven, hidden agenda that's not you, but so often gets the better of you and takes you over. Which, to say it in different language, Rav Kook claims that God is the taskmaster that gives you the deadlines and the framework to do what you really want to do. And that helps you to overcome that hidden material voice that's influenced by advertising and influenced by corporality and by selfishness and by a short-term perspective, helps you overcome that force that you want to overcome, such that in the best case scenario, serving God is really serving the true self, the true inner self. Rav Kook would claim the whole purpose of God's Torah is to release you from that force that's holding you back and give you the framework and ability to follow the true inner self, so that slavery to God, in that sense, is really freedom, is really, if you will, slavery to yourself. And you need slavery to yourself. You need a framework that helps you do what you want to do, so that you don't eat that other cookie and go fall asleep and waste your time or a million other things. We can give an example. And that explains for Rav Kook everything we said in the past hour and a half. That's why matzah is the bread of affliction that became the bread of freedom. To teach you that only through a certain type of slavery can you really experience the deepest, deepest level of a freedom. Of course, Rav Kook's assumption is that everyone inside is good. Very optimistic. Everyone inside is good. And all the forces that are asking you and telling you and forcing you and cajoling you to have another cookie, or to waste some time, to do evil, to cheat on your income tax, to smoke, whatever it might be, all those forces are not really you. And of course you want to overcome them. Everyone wants to overcome them. But many just don't have the koach, the power, the willpower. And the purpose of the Torah is that everyone find in the Torah that portion of Torah that connects to, that latches on to your personal, autonomous, good, divine soul. And the Torah therefore becomes your framework for overcoming and extricating yourself from the slavery to Paro, from the slavery to the urges, to advertisements, to corporality, the slavery to laziness. You're overcoming the slavery to Paro through latching onto and becoming part of servitude to a larger purpose that really coincides with who you really are. That's Rav Kook's understanding of slavery and freedom, and I think it's a very good understanding of matzah as we have it here in the Torah portion. And to me, this is a possible, plausible way of putting everything together in a meaningful fashion. So now, I know it's late. Actually, we have 10 seconds left. Does anyone want to say anything? Comment?
Rabbi, is it so different from what we learned some weeks back about without sin, there isn't goodness?
I didn't think of a connection.
But it's the tension.
I don't see a necessary connection. I see how it can be connected. Yeah.
You just said to me like it's all part of the same overriding. It can't be so simple.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Could be.
Tug and pull. It made me remember that class.
Great. Okay. I guess no one else wants to say anything. Okay, then I'll just say good evening.